The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
What's the best part of a Dunkin' Run? The coffee? Is it the coffee or the $1 donut or $2 stuffed bagel minis or $3 sausage, egg, and cheese that you can add to it? The answer, of course, is yes. Time for a Dunkin' Run. $3 offer available on sausage, egg, and cheese sandwich only. Excludes specialty donuts and fancies. Offer valid on medium or larger coffee. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer. Terms apply.
Hey, I'm Zach, and one day I'm going to make movies, but right now I'm young, dumb, and not nearly as good-looking as my co-hosts. So with the help of...
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
I'm Steven.
I'm going to learn what makes a movie great by watching all the classics I've skipped over. So pop the corn and turn your cell phone to silent, because it's time for a new episode of Zach on Film. I'm finally back from becoming a man, and thankful that I didn't stay at the Bates Motel while I was gone. Let's talk motels, mothers, and murder as we look at Psycho this week on Zach on Film.
Motels, mothers, and murder.
Isn't that, that's a show with Guy Fieri, isn't it?
Yeah.
On the Food Channel.
Fried food and frosted tips, baby.
Yeah.
Tips with a P.S.
Skips.
Oh.
Many tips.
Welcome back. Chips. Welcome back, Zach.
Hey, what's up?
Well, obviously a new film this week.
Yeah. Well, not new, but...
It's 45 years old.
What? No, 45? Is it really 45?
60-something.
1960 is when this movie came out.
So it's Psycho. 55 years old.
Psycho is the movie that we're talking about this week. Mm-hmm. Alfred Hitchcock. And we've actually got... I don't know how this worked out this way, but we've actually got a bunch of Alfred Hitchcock movies coming up.
This is our third Hitchcock film to date, isn't it? We watched...
High Noon was Hitchcock.
No. Vertigo.
We watch Vertigo.
Vertigo and Strangers on a Train.
And yeah. Strangers on a Train.
It happened on Mulberry
Street. We still haven't. Again, this is all on this list that other people have compiled, and yeah. I kind of whittled down, not really paying attention. We've got North by Northwest. We're doing Psycho today. Mm-hmm. We've got Rear Window on the way.
Yeah.
We've got... That may be the only ones that we have left. Dial M for Murder is on the list, too. So there's four more Alfred Hitchcock movies on this list.
Yeah.
Well, he was.
I think actually,
well, let me ask you that. So let's ask you this, Rodrigo. Why Alfred Hitchcock? Why does he show up on this list more than Steven Spielberg shows up on this list, more than Martin Scorsese shows up on this list, more than any other director, John Ford?
Mm-hmm.
He shows up on this list more than anyone else.
Well, I think it's because this list has a strong emphasis on technical aspects.
Mm.
And when it comes to technical aspects, Alfred Hitchcock was both a pioneer and great at implementing them.
Mm-hmm.
So some of these techniques were around before,
yeah.
But he implements them really well in movies that are worth watching.
Yeah.
And then some of them were like brand new invented for these movies.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because... Hitchcock's career, I mean, this dude was, by the time Psycho comes out in 1960, he had been working in the film industry for like 40 years already.
Long, long time.
By the time Psycho hit, that put that into perspective. Mm-hmm. By the time, go back and look at Alfred Hitchcock on the IMDb. By the time that Psycho hit, I think his first film came out in like 1929, yeah. Something like that. He'd been working in the industry for 30 years to get to this point.
Mm-hmm.
And in that time... I think beyond the technical, I think Alfred Hitchcock learns the craft of what makes a fascinating story. And he's had things from Rope to, 29 Steps to whatever that he's done all throughout this time, where he can say, okay, what is making people tweak this way? What are making people lean this way? What gets this reaction from people? And now when we look at what we consider Alfred Hitchcock's prime from, the mid-50s through mid-60s, early 50s to the mid-60s, where he's really hitting his stride with North by Northwest and Rear Window and all this stuff, that he's really figured out this is what makes audiences tick. Mm-hmm. And I think that's fascinating to just, and I, again, put that into perspective. the man's first film, I believe, came out in 1929, if not sooner.
Yeah.
I mean,
1923.
Okay, so roughly the same time that talkies came into existence. A little bit before. He's working in some silent stuff here. So from the time of silent film through Technorama and surround sound, Alfred Hitchcock was there doing stuff.
Yeah.
And that is mind-blowing, right? I mean, when you think about it.
Yeah.
I mean, you think, I mean, well, and I think it's only because we're looking at it from our scope of our own being of, I've been alive since this time and I've lived to this time.
Right.
And
which
I've
for seen Zach all of is this. Like seconds.
I know, but I have seen all of this stuff that has happened in this time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But Alfred Hitchcock got to see it all.
Yeah.
Well, and that's important, too, is like part of the reason why there's so much Hitchcock in the film is not just because he was good at it, but because he was formative.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because he was one of the guys who were there when film was young.
Right.
You know, eventually other people may have come up with these things, but he was one of the guys who was in there doing it the whole time, pretty much. You know,
and he's pretty prolific, too. I mean, if you look at the films that he's done.
Absolutely. Yeah.
From 23 to 1978, he's basically doing a film every 2 to 3 years, sometimes 2 and 3 a year.
Yep.
Yeah, it's just
crazy. And furthermore, it's like he exists in a system that is very different from our modern systems. I mean, just, for example, how long it takes to make a movie.
Right. Sure. Well, you know, he worked in the British film system for a long time before he came to America and started doing films like Psycho. And so he's bringing a lot of what he learned there to here and then vice versa. So, yeah, Rodrigo, you're absolutely right in that sense. There is a great new Filmmaker IQ video that was posted. I thought this guy had blown up and gone away because I think the last one he did was like in March.
Yeah.
The new one is on sound.
Mm-hmm.
And if you put that in perspective of Hitchcock, he was there from the time sound is entering all the way up to, when did Hitchcock die?
1980
something. So he was able to see surround sound fully resolve into THX, which is the top end of the audio file before DTS and all that stuff came into it.
Mm.
Just being able to sit there and witness that stuff is mind-boggling.
Oh, sure.
Being able to tell my kids someday that I remember when my computer did, you know, was at a 300 baud pretty amazing.
You remember. You,
I know.
As a child, did not own a computer.
No, that's right.
You, as a child, did not own a computer. That's going to be mind-boggling for your children.
I know. Well, and grandchildren.
Yeah.
You know, it's just going to be, well, even for Zach. Maybe even for you. Did you have a computer as a kid?
I did a lot for the majority of my childhood, but it's like, it's because my parents were involved in that. My parents were like computer people from the beginning, but yeah, not everybody did. And I mean, I remember when we got the internet. You know, the internet, that's another thing that's going to be mind-boggling for your kids.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The internet wasn't always around, and you remember a time when the internet wasn't around, and they'll be like, what kind of cowboy hat and poncho did you wear when that was happening?
Like the kids' grandparents were here a couple of weeks ago during Zach's wedding, and I was regaling them with tales of black and white televisions and televisions the size of the chair that you are sitting in, Rodrigo, with a little 20-inch screen, and that was the big deal. And the kids were like, really, black and white? So you were in black and white when you were a kid? And it's like, it doesn't comprehend.
Yeah.
Likewise, going back to Alfred Hitchcock, when you look at, Matthew, what's the IMDb say? How many movies does Hitchcock have?
Well, some of the movies that he made are
directed 69 movies.
Yeah.
69 movies that he directed.
Good Lord.
That's a lot of movies. And he only lived for 80 years. Think about that.
Only 80.
He makes his first movie when he's 21.
Yeah.
That is literally a movie and a half a year for the rest of his life.
Sounds fascinating, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It sounds amazing.
Somebody who clearly loved movies, too.
Just from that perspective, a couple of things. These young kids. Young people who are 25 and are like, oh, my career, it's never going to go anywhere. It's like, I'm 25. My career's almost over. I'm almost ready for retirement. I can't get a break in this industry.
First of all, those people, shut up.
No, but there's a lot of them out there, right?
I know, but they need to shut up.
Alfred Hitchcock didn't have Psycho become the huge hit that it was until 30 films in.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
It takes time. It takes a long time.
What would you say was his first huge worldwide hit? Would it be maybe Rent?
If I were going to look at his filmography,
maybe Rebecca was Rebecca.
Rebecca would probably be one of the early ones.
That was when he was 40, 41.
No. Saboteur, 1942, would have been, I think, the one that a lot of people would recognize as his big breakthrough. That was the one, if I remember
then you
correctly.
Start seeing Lifeboat and Rope and Strangers on a Train and all like that.
Yeah. Saboteur is the one where this guy is in a town and they accuse him of being a saboteur.
Right in the title.
It's great.
That, that's why the song is called.
But if you don't, if you go back, and God, is Saboteur the one that I'm thinking of? I forget. One of these has like Orson Welles and all these people in it. It's like more of a comedy. Mr. and Mrs. Smith, people would know that. Rebecca, Rebecca is probably girl, the lady vanishes. Man, the guy's got Sabotage. 39 Steps. There we go. Let's go with 39 Steps.
That's probably good.
Oh, man, the man who knew too much. God dang it. He keeps going back.
I would say 39 Steps is the big one.
Alfred Hitchcock was successful since the beginning of time.
Yeah. He was.
Apparently, Hitchcock made the first talkie
in England
that came out of Britain.
Yeah.
This is interesting because he's not just like he understands the film, but when these things happen, when these sea changes happen in the industry, Hitchcock is like, I don't know if it's like an instinctual process for him. He's always there doing these things at the forefront of whatever.
It's because he's doing it, right? So if you look at something, let's take podcasting, for example.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Podcasting is a relatively new medium. Podcasting still has a lot of
growth
to do.
Yeah.
It still has a lot of its own medium to become.
Right.
Podcasting borrows a lot from radio, from television, from previous media.
Mm-hmm.
There's guys out there who all of a sudden are like, wait a minute. My podcast doesn't have to be half an hour, right? And then all of a sudden, you start seeing podcasts that expand or retract to an average commute, which is a smart idea,
mm-hmm.
to 2 hours to 6 hours, you know, depending on kind of what they want. But it takes somebody to be like, wait a minute, we don't have to do it this way to do it. You know, when films, you know, when you transition from silent films to talkies, you have people that are visionaries, which, you know, often what it takes to be a visionary is to have that ability to forget what the strictures are, the language already is, and kind of invent your new language as you go. And Alfred Hitchcock is one of those people. Mm-hmm. He's one of those people who say, we don't have to be bound by the traditional narrative as it exists now. We don't have to be bound by a card in front of the movie that tells you exactly what's going to happen. It's actually more exciting if you don't know what's going to happen.
I will over at the Major Spoilers website, I will embed that filmmaker IQ piece. It's about 30 minutes long where he goes through the history of talkies, and he doesn't hit all the points that I think he could really have gone on for about 2 hours on the history of sound and the business of it, especially in Hollywood. But it's fascinating to look at it. But what you said a moment ago, Rodrigo, about story structure and narrative, and going back to what I had mentioned before about Hitchcock at this point in his life has kind of clicked in what works with people.
Yeah.
What makes Psycho, Matthew, what makes Psycho such a resonating film that when most people say when you say Alfred Hitchcock, most people would instantly say Psycho as opposed to Birds or Rear Window or North by Northwest or some of that other stuff. I would bet 90% of the people, if they knew who Alfred Hitchcock was, number one, would say, name one Alfred Hitchcock film, they'd instantly say Psycho. Why?
Yeah. I think, and to digress for just a moment beforehand, there is a relatively popular, although somewhat discredited filmmaker who floats around Hollywood right now. His name is M. Night Shyamalan. whose gimmick is all of his movies have a big surprise at the end. Psycho is a movie that almost but not quite hits that sort of trick movie thing where there's not one,
there's two
surprises.
Two twists.
So it's not a movie that's a twist movie, but it's a really easy one to remember. The story itself, if you've ever read the original story, is really terrifying in and of itself. Hitchcock took a really strong piece of writing, and then he put it on the screen and completely, I don't want to say undermined, but all of your expectations going into this movie are shot down quickly. Because you meet this character and she seems to be one thing, but she's not. And she seems to be doing something, but she's not. And then the thing happens where that first big twist comes up and it turns out, holy crap, this isn't even a movie about her at all.
Yeah, it's what, a third of the way through it and Janet Leigh is killed.
Yeah, this is one of those movies that is the equivalent of a really good, entertaining monologue by somebody where you don't realize that you keep getting redirected. You don't realize throughout this movie that it keeps not being what you think it is. And then you get to the end and it's still not what you think it is when you didn't think what you thought it was at the beginning. I mean, this is a movie that really subverts, even if you go in as somebody who, you know, has studied movie theory beforehand, knows the movie's ending, because the first time I saw it, I knew how it ended. I already knew the twisty twist. But as you go into this movie, it's still surprises you. It's the equivalent of that weird guy who's somehow also likable. And everything that Hitchcock has done with this film has made it so structurally unstoppable. I mean, that's not the word I'm looking for.
No, but I mean,
it's watertight. It's structurally watertight to where no matter what he does, you go, oh. It's that surprise that is such a good surprise.
And yeah, I think you got to it when you said there's a twist. There's two twists. Janet Leigh dies a third of the way through. That's the famous shower scene.
Yep.
And then you have the whole thing of it's not Norman's mother. It's Norman.
Right.
And the mom is decaying in the basement. You know, you're right. Those are two big twists that audiences don't expect to happen, because part of the agreement that you have with, as a filmmaker, with your audience, is they're going to go in with an expectation.
Yep.
You're going in to share a story with them. So even though you're not present for that movie, there is an unspoken dialogue and exchange that you come in with me. I'm going to embrace my arms around you and I'm going to tell you a story.
Mm-hmm.
And it might be a scary story. It might be a fun story. It might be a musical, might be whatever, but you're going to kind of know how this story flows.
Mm-hmm.
Hitchcock invites people in to see Psycho, has them say, here, please sit down, and then yanks the chair out from under them as they're about to sit.
It's, you know, I think in that analogy, it's like when you pick up, like when you're playing with
a little baby child,
your son or little brother or cousin or whatever, and you're like doing something and telling something, and then you like drop your arms.
Yeah.
And they don't know. They think they're going to fall forever and die, right? And then, but then you catch them, and it's the most exciting thing that's ever happened to them. Yeah, and they just laugh and laugh, right?
Or just peekaboo. Peekaboo is the same way.
That's what Alfred Hitchcock is doing to us.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, oh, I'm going to tell you this story. Like, bam. It's like, oh, wait, the movie's still going. What's going to happen now?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
I think there's two things that are separate that make movies enjoyable. One of them is that fulfillment of that expectation, and another is the surprise from when those expectations are changed. There's a safe way to make a movie, which is to just follow the formula, give people exactly what they expect, and they'll come out. The majority of people will come out relatively pleased that Bruce Willis shot everyone.
Right.
Or that Jennifer Aniston and whoever she's up against got together at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Perfectly fine.
Sure.
And then there's the other way of doing movies. As an extreme example, probably like your Quentin Tarantino's, where literally you can't tell what the structure of the movie is. Mm-hmm. You don't know what the next thing is that's going to happen. Right. That's a lot riskier. You stand to alienate a lot more people. But when it's effective, it's that much more of a payoff because it's that much bigger of a risk.
Right. It's like David Lynch.
But the thing is, people going into seeing Psycho at this time already know that they're going in to watch a thriller of some kind or something that's suspenseful. And suspenseful is something that Hitchcock has done basically throughout. Look at like what I mentioned a moment ago with The Man Who Knew Too Much. It's about people who find out that there's a kidnapping plot, and then the kidnappers kidnap the daughter and say, if you say anything, we're going to kill your daughter. And what are they going to do? Mm-hmm. So people are already going in knowing this. But when you kill a major well-known character and star in the first 30 minutes or whatever it is, and then the rest of the time you're supposed to follow this guy and the people trying to investigate her disappearance, that is a mind F to your audience. Yeah. It really is. And the only, and you're right, when you mention M. Night, when you look at The Sixth Sense, that's exactly what he's doing.
Sure.
He screws with your mind and says, ha, ha, ha.
And the
it's
the
really
reason,
modern times.
The reason why this, it's the lady in the devil elevator. The reason why The Sixth Sense was successful and no other M. Night Shyamalan movie was successful is because people weren't expecting it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But
right.
after that, everybody's just sitting there waiting for the twist, and it just never is satisfying, because also The Sixth Sense has probably the best twist out of any M. Night Shyamalan movie.
Right.
But what I think
go ahead.
I like Lady in the Lake.
Special about Psycho, from what I read about it, is that he did the twist, the double twists, but also the way Hitchcock did the marketing for this film, it's he like let people into this secret club almost. It's like, don't tell anyone what happens.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because you don't want to ruin anything. And he did a lot of marketing that went into this film to keep the thing secret and to make sure people saw the movie the way they were they should see it and not the way the normal people were seeing it at the time, with the newsreels and stuff before coming in halfway and seeing twists before they should have.
Right.
And so he... So it's not like the modern day culture now is
too savvy.
No,
too connected.
We like our spoilers and we want them now.
What?
So
there were a website that talked about spoilers.
Yeah. So,
but not the little spoilers, the major
way
spoilers.
Hitchcock really marketed this film was making like a kind of like club. Of you know what's going to happen in Psycho.
Yeah,
you don't want to tell anyone.
P.T. Barnum Carney trick, right? Where you tell everybody to come see the house, the mystery shack in Gravity Falls. This way, people look at the crazy horse, and now look at the crazy duck. Mm-hmm. Now this way to the egress, and look at the conjoined twins, and this way to the egress, everybody. You don't want to miss the egress. Move along, move along, move along. And then people going, oh, the egress is this way. Let's hurry up and get to the egress. Forget the talking dog. Let's get to the egress. Mm-hmm. Wait a minute. The egress is just an exit. And then the Carney or P.T. Barnum winking at them and saying, well, now you could get really mad and go tell everybody else that you just spend a nickel to see to get to the egress, or we could keep it all a secret to ourselves and let the other person be fooled too. And what fun is that going to be when everybody gets fooled? And you're right, that is a good marketing kind of gimmick. And
but it's the power thing. I mean, Zach nailed it. When you talk about, I don't think that today's audience are necessarily more savvy, but I think that today's audiences have a different expectation. And when you, let's say you have a secret, you know that it was his sled, and your friend says, I'm going to go see this movie, and you go, oh man, it's the sled. You have that power. Hitchcock knew that. He undermined that with this. And bear in mind, this is, what, 3 or 4 years into the run of his weekly television program, which is all about twist endings, which in theory could have Shyamalan'd him, but didn't, because
Set
of the way
now.
The film... Shyamalan. It's Shyamalan is where you get hung by your own metaphorical petard.
Yeah.
Whatever your shtick is, your shtick turns on you. Rodrigo is killed by being smart and thoughtful. Zach is killed by being young and cute. I'm killed by being cynical and fat. Steven is killed by being less fat but infinitely more cynical. Steven is killed by jaguars, but
that's why I work down in the basement, because they can't jump out of trees and get me.
That's right.
Jaguars. And there aren't any
jaguars
trees
can't walk down steps.
That's
Loader
a myth.
Bears.
It's like dogs can't look up.
They say the
jaguars can't
walk
down
stairs.
No, they can.
Dogs can't look up.
That's ridiculous.
Down the stairs. They completely just, they come down the stairs at a full butt. But yes. And when you look at, first of all, not just what this film shows you, not just what it puts together and goes, here is the story, and here's the story, and here's Martin Balsam, and here's the thing, and here's this terrifying ending. And I will grant you that the ending may hammer the point home a little too hard for me. Maybe it may just be a new thing in this latest viewing where they're kind of like, no, and perhaps Norman never existed anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But
sure.
Ebert says that. He said he would have re-edited the ending to cut out
the way this film is put together. And I think this is part of the reason why we remember Hitchcock. This is a film that is really beautifully assembled. So even if the story was crap and didn't work, I think people would still look at this as a notable film just in the way it's shot and the way it's edited.
Well, so there's something else going on in this movie, which I find fascinating too. And I didn't do the research on this like I should have, but I find it fascinating that this movie, it doesn't glorify the serial killer or the psychopath. And it kind of does, just in the name itself. Mm-hmm. But when we look at movies today like Red Dragon and Silence of the Lambs you could even go check Texas Chainsaw Massacre kind of stuff. I think it goes back to, Psycho to a point. I mean, further to M, and you look at the child killer, and we've looked at that movie here. But I think when you look at Psycho, it turns the audience's expectation to, oh my God, look how insane crazy this psychopath is. I want to see more stories about psychopaths.
Absolutely. You know, the psychopath, the murderous psychopath is that hidden monster, right?
Right.
They look just like everyone else, as long as they're white.
Well, most serial killers are white males.
Yeah.
So, they look just like everyone else, but they have a secret. And it's like, it's like they're mutants, like they're something else, but you can't tell who's a serial killer, right? Mm. So that idea is hugely interesting. That, and as more and more research was done into people who have that kind of dissociative thing about empathy and stuff, you know, psychopaths, sociopaths, not that they're the same thing. But as much research has been done, you start seeing patterns.
Right.
And these patterns are really unique to each individual person. Mm-hmm. So it makes them rock stars. It makes them quirky. It makes them interesting. It makes them, studyable.
Right.
And even, if you look at the MO of Norman, like, that's something that's really complex and thorough, right? It's like mom issues, turns into the mom, kills people, doesn't remember stuff.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's super interesting.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what people get out of serial killers. They're like, it's like old school magic stuff, right? Where there were rules that kept you from being eaten by monsters. Mm-hmm. It's like serial killers follow their own weird rules.
And follow a pattern. You look at what's the HBO series or the Showtime series, Dexter.
Mm-hmm.
Same way, you're following somebody who's a psychopath that has a very set amount of rules that his father instilled upon him, your stepfather instilled upon him, because he knew that this kid was crazy.
Well, and then he could... psycho.
That if he could use him for good, then it would keep him from being a true monster.
Right.
You can look at there was another series that I was thinking of that kind of explored the same thing, but I think Red Dragon and Silence of the Lambs with what's his name? The killer in the Silence of the Lambs.
Not Lecter.
No.
Buffalo Bill.
Yeah. That he follows his own set of specific.
Yeah.
Rules that he has to do. And even if you look at John Wayne Gacy and you look at the real life serial killers, it's crazy.
And the original story was inspired, and certainly inspired is the word, by Ed Gein, who is the same character who inspired the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which should be on the list, by the way. But yeah, it's kind of like a superhero in a weird way. You don't know if the person next to you is Superman or if he's Norman Bates.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
I'm trying to refresh my memory on Psycho today since it's been so long since we actually should have watched a couple weeks ago, but
we should have talked about it a couple of weeks ago, but you were sick.
I was
sick. You had
sick,
a wedding, and then you had to go on a honeymoon,
and blah blah blah.
My name's Zach, and I had to get married.
My life is better than all yours.
Doing a lot of reading about it, and one article that I really found interesting was talking about how Alfred Hitchcock used our own personal fears against us in the movie. Fear of failing your mother, fear of the police, fear of you have something inside of you that you can't control.
Yeah.
Which I found really interesting. And upon reflection, it was like totally, because especially the police officer, how that character is used to paranoid. What's her name in the beginning?
Janet Leigh's character.
Lee's character. And just the visuals that they get right up in his face when he gets right in her window, and that's like fills up the whole screen, or he's across the street, his arms folded, just like staring at you behind those glasses. You don't even know if he's looking at you, but you just assume he is because the police are obviously out to get you.
Do you think, and again, maybe this is a question we can talk when we're closer to the end of Zach on Film, once we've seen all these other Hitchcock movies. You think Hitchcock figured out what the pattern was and just started to repeat that pattern? Because if we look at Vertigo, if we look at Rear Window, if we look at Psycho, if we look at North by North, when North by Northwest, maybe not so much because it followed more into the pre-Psycho kind of trope. But he seemed to say, okay, what are people's phobias?
Sure.
What are people really scared of? And now how can I play upon that and make sure that every frame is filled with something that is going to make the audience super, super tense?
I think Hitchcock was an artist. And he was a commercial artist. You know, he knew what worked, but also his movies are rich. His movies are innovative. He's not just saying, okay, what else are people afraid of? Lizards. Let's make a movie about lizards, right? It's not just that. It's like in Psycho, they could have just made a movie about a serial killer. Like M. In M, there's a point where you just start following the serial killer, right?
Yeah.
That becomes less exciting. You start kind of weirdly empathizing with the serial killer.
And at the end of the movie, you do empathize.
Yeah, at the end of the movie, he's basically the protagonist, right? And he could have done that.
Yeah.
He could have said, who's the most important character? Let's follow the serial killer. But he didn't. You know, in Vertigo.
Which came out before Psycho. Right. So maybe Psycho is the culmination of all of
this. Sure. You know, in Vertigo, there was a more straight way to play that. But the whole point is that mystery, right? I think that, he starts figuring out this pattern. But also, he doesn't want to be bored by it. It seems to me there's a lot of like fun. Like there's like some weird Alfred Hitchcocky whimsy to his movies. And you can tell that he's kind of in like it,
laughing, enjoying it.
Yeah. Enjoying it. Just putting weird characters in, like having a conversation between two characters that doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But they're there and it's interesting.
What makes Hitchcock's characters in this movie feel so full and fully developed? Because you don't walk away from this going, well, this character's storyline was not developed in this way, or it's missing these development points. Mm-hmm. These characters feel super fleshed out. These characters feel like people that you do know. You empathize with them very well. And you do it a lot more than, I think, honestly, than you do when you see what's his name in Vertigo?
Jimmy Stewart.
Yeah. In Vertigo, or even Jimmy Stewart in Rear Window. Rear Window is still, I think, maybe a better movie, but you watch a movie like Psycho and you're like, these are real people.
Yeah.
Maybe, just because I'm falling back on the same article I just referenced. Instead of developing super backstory filled characters, using the same traits that used to heighten our tension in the film, he's also using those are also found in the characters as little Norman Bates is like little tics and stuff. It's not. Right. It's little personality traits inside the characters that we fill with our own personal memories of.
That's right. It's cues,
yeah,
right?
Cues, so cues.
You see these two people, and they don't say, "Well, since we just had sex in this hotel room, we should." Yeah. You know, it's like from the very beginning, you're dropped into the situation, and you're already making those connections. You're like, "Those two just had sex in a hotel room,
right?
And they're not married." Oh no! Yeah. And then it's like, your own brain is filling in all those details, like violence that happens on off screen,
right?
And you fill in, and it's like so much more intense and crazy when your own brain does the work for Alfred Hitchcock.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing with these characters, right? All he has to do is drop this hint, and this hint, and you doing the work for him makes it so much more satisfying,
right?
Yes, it makes it personal. And I think to some degree, I've been reading a lot lately about people talking about how really good comedians are generally people who have a great sadness in their core.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that from what you read about Hitchcock, people say he was kind of a jerk in life. He was, he was kind of schmucky. And I think that part of that comes from, it's that same sort of dichotomy. Hitchcock knows character because he spends his time kind of being a jerk and poking at people to see how they respond. Sure. And being, you know, kind of being awful and really getting to the core of what people are honestly going to be like. And to some degree, I think that that has to be something you take into, especially in this film, but you have to take that into consideration. I think part of the reason that he knows humanity so well is because he kind of stands aside and goes, "All right, now I'm going to hit you in the face with this rock. Tell me how you feel." That's my Alfred Hitchcock, by the way.
I have something to add to that.
Okay.
Let's give a little shout out really quick. This episode is brought to you in part by Major Spoilers VIP members around the world. Thank you for your support of MajorSpoilers.com and the Major Spoilers Podcast Network. If you'd like to become a bronze, silver, or gold VIP member, go to members.majorspoilers.com and sign up today. Thank you in advance.
Yeah, thank you for your support.
Yes.
You were talking about filling in the gaps.
Yep.
You know, we don't have to see people having sex. We know that they had sex.
Right, right.
Yes. It's clear.
It's funny, though. The most famous scene, one of the most famous scenes in film history has to be the shower scene.
Sure.
Where she's being stabbed repeatedly. Took them 7 days, 78 different setups to get this shot correctly.
Just right.
Yeah, they had to make sure that the pasties weren't going to fall off.
Right.
So they didn't violate any standards, any haze codes, any pasty laws. Any pasty
laws. This is post-haze code, though, isn't it?
I don't remember, but it was definitely, there was a ratings board in place at this time. Because when he took this movie to be shown... Mm-hmm. They were like, "Oh no, there's definitely some naked body bits that we can see on the screen. You're going to have to go back and re-edit." And the way the story goes, I don't know if it's true or not. Right. But Hitchcock said, "Okay, I'll go back and re-edit this so everybody's happy." And he went back and did nothing to that stabbing in the shower sequence. Took it back about a month or two later, and they're like, "Oh yeah, this is fine. Yep. No problem."
And from other stories I've read, he obviously was pretty savvy with the board. Because when he submitted the script originally, before they started making it, he added parts in there that were more risque and sexual than what he wanted to keep. Mm. So they would focus on that. They said there was inferences to Norman's sexual relations with his mother.
With his mom, yeah.
That he put in there, knowing they would take it out.
Right.
So he could get other stuff under the radar from him.
Well, you know, they say... I've done this before, and it works really, really well, that when you're working with a client that or a boss, that you intentionally make some big, glaring mistakes so that the boss or the president of your university can come in and go, "Oh, you people are idiots. You didn't see this big thing right here. I'm so brilliant because I'm going to come in and fix this.
That's why I'm the boss."
Yeah.
And then he secretly totally misses... all the stuff that you wanted to keep in anyway, and it becomes a non-issue because everyone but that person knows that you're intentionally putting this mistake in so that the person in charge feels like they have become involved.
I'm not saying I was taught to do that by certain people I work with.
But no, that I mean, that's an example of managing.
Have you done that at work?
Upwards.
Yeah.
Yeah. I used to do that all the time.
I did that all the time. All the time.
Yeah.
It's legit.
Yeah, and it works. And so yeah, that's a good way of of knowing people, studying people. And I don't think that Hitchcock would be Hitchcock if he spent all day in his room watching the internet and talking on internet boards, right?
Sure.
I think what makes Hitchcock Hitchcock is the fact that he was out and understood people and interacted with people, and he knew what made people work.
Right.
And even though it may be creepy, we don't really have a good mall here to do this, but people watching at the mall, I think, is a valid way to see how people interact. And if you don't know how a new young married couple acts and you're writing a movie about this new young married couple, by God, you better go expose yourself to, well, don't expose yourself to new married couples, but you better find out where people in love are at and watch them, right?
Yep,
if you want to see how teenagers act and you're 44, you better go where the teenagers are.
You get that, right? You get 44-year-olds writing teenagers, and it's like, hey, cool man.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What's the tubular today?
Oh, you want to know
how's
how
it bringing?
So check this out. Again, it was probably another podcast, probably Nerdist, because they have some really great interviews. If you guys haven't listened to the Nerdist podcast, you really should. They were doing one of the writers' interviews, and it was somebody who had worked on, like, High School Musical. Mm-hmm. And they were working on, like, the third year of the High School Musical. Mm-hmm. And they're like, we have no idea what kids are into. Is the third High School Musical the one where they go to prom?
I don't know.
Oh, I thought maybe you did.
No.
He was too young for High School Musical.
I have no idea.
But one of the writers had a daughter who was getting ready to have their prom. And they're like, oh, let's call her up, get her on the phone. And so they're talking with her on the phone earlier, like, we want to know what the big thing is for prom this year so that we can write this, so we know what you kids are into. And the niece or the daughter or whoever was just like, we're kind of waiting for the High School Musical to come out because that's how we're going to theme our prom.
Oh, nice.
And it was real funny. It's like, here are these 45-year-olds that are writing and influencing what the young kids are doing. And that's what Hitchcock is doing. He's influencing these younger filmmakers because he understands how people think and how they work. And he's able to observe that human nature and translate that human nature into a movie like Psycho. Now, I don't know. Did you do some research on beyond just him translating a book, adapting the book? Did he go and talk with psycho killers?
Not that I know of. I know he sent people to buy all the copies of the book out of the bookstores. No one could read it.
Oh, so they weren't spoiled ahead of time?
Yeah.
Ah, that's clever.
That's all I know.
That's clever. But you're gonna have to do research, Zach.
Oh yeah.
Write what you know, write what you own, right?
Yeah.
Did you guys study Psycho? Oh, go finish your
I was gonna say, you know, eventually your own writing is gonna take you out of your wheelhouse, right?
Mm-hmm.
Probably because you have to write exciting things, and if you're a writer like me, it's like not that many exciting things have happened to you. So it's like eventually you're going to have to do some amount of research.
You're going to have to do a lot of research. I find that fascinating when you look at H.P. Lovecraft and you look at Robert E. Howard, how here's a guy up in New England writing about all these different cities around the world. And you're looking at this guy in West Texas who's writing these fantastical tales of adventure. These guys were doing research. They were going to their library. They were contacting different people and finding out what are things like in this position.
You look
or in
at
these places.
You look at a company like Disney. You know, they have a long tradition of being like, we want to do a movie about that takes place in South America. Let's send everybody to South America, and they just send their people down to like absorb at the very least the look of the area.
That was also part of a Goodwill tour that the U.S. government set up.
Back in those days, yeah.
To set it up so that
they wouldn't
Latin
join the Germans.
Yeah, so they wouldn't join the Germans. Yeah. So essentially they just sent Disney and a bunch of his animators down to South America.
I mean, that's what the Three Caballeros is.
There's a whole series. Three
Saludos Amigos.
Saludos Amigos. That's what that's all based on, was that result. But yeah, they research it. I mean, even if you look at Bambi, if you want to look at it from that point, they go and they study real animals.
They shot deer. They shot like 35 deer. They're like, wait, I still don't see how it fell. Let's go ahead and shoot another deer.
A lot of poaching.
Did
Bambi.
Uh, watching Psycho now, I mean, we've really kind of just danced around a lot of this movie, which is fine because I think there's some bigger themes that are going on.
Yeah.
Doctor Who always talks about these fixed points in history. I think Psycho is one of those films that is just like this fixed point, which everything else kind of orbits around.
Interesting. I mean, it's a very important and influential film.
Knowing, did you know what Norman's deal was before you watched this movie?
Interesting.
So let me say this. Without having watched the new TV show, Bates Motel.
That's where the interesting part comes in. I knew one thing about Psycho.
Which was? The shower scene. Okay.
Only thing I knew about Psycho. I start watching Psycho, and it gets to about 30, 25 minutes in. They get to the Bates Motel. I go, isn't there a show on like AMC or something that's Bates Motel? And sure enough, I get on my IMDb. I'm like, oh, Norman Bates. Aubrey, my now wife, loves that show. I'm going
to
pause this.
It's fun to say, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm going to pause this. We'll watch it together because she likes it.
Yeah.
So we're going along. All these murders are happening. And she goes, you know, I wonder if that's Norman doing the murders, because in the show, he gets really mad and just forgets what he's doing sometimes. And I go, yep, that's how it ended. Of course, she fell asleep and also did not watch the end because I go, because they start going down to the basement. Oh, she didn't fall asleep. She just stopped watching. They're going down to the basement. The music starts building, and you know that like a big jump scare or something's going to come. So she's just covering her eyes. And then Norman, they do like a quick cut to Norman dressed as his mom, which I think is one of the scariest images I have ever seen in my entire life. I yell. She doesn't get to see it, but yeah. No, so she kind of spoiled for me, but that was cool.
In the Bates Motel, Norman's not murdering people?
Not that I know. I mean, I think she's only watched season one.
Okay.
There is a second season. I believe.
Yes.
So it's interesting, mainly because I don't know if... Because
it would really suck.
There's something about Norman's mom possibly killing, like, a stepdad or something.
Oh, okay.
Or someone that is close to Norman dies.
Mm-hmm.
And she sounded like it was the mom that did it. Of course, knowing this, who knows?
It would be very sad if the TV show, which is a prequel to this movie, ends up ruining the movie in its... It, almost like Star Wars Episode One, where you actually watch Anakin Skywalker...
Does the show, though, take place in the 60s?
It takes place when Norman is a young, like, 12, 13 years old.
I mean, if the show isn't if the show isn't supposed to be a prequel, then it doesn't matter. Right? If it takes place in modern times, it already doesn't fit.
Oh, I don't think it takes place in modern times, does it?
I honestly haven't watched a single episode.
By the way, they in Universal Studios.
Yes,
they used to have the Bates Motel.
Yes. Uh-huh.
They've now either moved it or changed it, and now they have a Curious George like little amusement thing. Freaks me out, man.
The series is a contemporary prequel to the '60s Psycho.
Yeah,
so it takes place in the present.
Yes, but it's
a
prequel.
Has to be the past of a movie that
so there's going
to
be time travel involved. I'm in on board on this movie now.
He travels
back to the past.
I mean, it's
kills
his mother.
Sure.
It's Casino Royale, right?
Yeah.
It's the first Bond movie, but also the last Bond movie.
Yeah.
Would they throw time travel into stupid places? It'll ruin something like, you know, Paranormal Activity. That's all I'm saying.
So we're kind of way off the rails this week. What do you get out of this, Zach?
I thought the double twist thing was fantastic. I mean, we talked about.
Are you going to start using double? You're going to start using twists in all of your projects?
Well, no, that'd be very hard to do when
like you're doing a water conservation piece and the water constantly drips, and it's like, are you wasting water? And then you cut to a dead body on the floor, and it's really. I mean, that's something that your audience wouldn't expect.
Here's the thing, though.
Sure.
You can use a twist, even in documentary stuff.
Yeah.
Where
catfish,
or something where you are like, ha ha ha, look at these terrible things that these people are doing, And then you like bring it around to try to like, basically you trick, like you trick the right into watching your leftist documentary or vice versa,
right?
By promoting it and showing things that they agree with and then showing them how they are wrong, at least in your, you know, view.
But what are your thoughts on the twist?
Well, I think the first twist is the more interesting twist because we've already spent 30 minutes establishing our central focus character as lady whose name I can't remember.
Marion.
And then we change it by gender, by age, by like mental stability.
Mm-hmm.
We just completely change characters in a drastic way by brutally murdering our first character, stuffing her in a trunk, and pushing the car into the bottom of a pond. I mean, that was huge. And you got the audience on the side of the murderer because you think he's trying to like help his mother cover up a murder. And one of the weird parts, I thought it was weirdly kind of funny, was he puts Mary in the trunk, pushes the car into the pond, and it's a really long shot of it just like sinking into the lake.
Yeah.
And then it kind of just sits there. I'm like, car's not going to sink, that idiot. And then it drops.
There's like, this happens, this also happens in Strangers on a Train.
Yeah.
Right.
Where a big part of the suspense at the end is the murderer going to be able to incriminate the main character? And you're like, oh no, is it a ring? No, it's the
glasses.
It's the
The lighter?
Yeah, the lighter, right?
Yeah.
It's like, oh no, the lighter fell down the grate. Wait a minute. Why am I worried about this? If the lighter falls down the grate, that's a good thing.
Yeah,
oh no, he got it back.
Yeah. So what else? What else do you get from this?
I really found what Hitchcock did around the film to market it, to bring people in, really fascinating. Because you read like what he did, where he made movie theaters stop people from walking in. Because they talk about they usually have newsreels, like a short film before the movie. People would walk in at the movie started and just sit for the whole thing and get back to the, like, watch the first 15 minutes they missed.
Yeah.
But he made movie theaters say, no, you have to go in when the movie starts and you have to watch it completely through, which then they said created lines, which made people more interested in the movie because there's all these people lined up to see a film when they normally wouldn't have been. They would have been in there watching it probably right after Marion died or something. Mm-hmm. It's things like that, how Hitchcock actually sat in the mother's chair and poses pictures to make it seem like the mother was actually a character in the film. Uh-huh. He told reporters that it was a story about a boy with like a murderous mother. They all took promo pictures where they're looking at this empty mother's chair. I just thought the way they portrayed the film and how they did it on such a small budget.
Is that misleading? Is that misleading the audience?
Just some degree, the whole film is misleading the audience, so why not mislead them in the marketing?
I think it's the equivalent of lying to a child about the existence of certain creatures who come and take away their teeth in the night. It's the kind of misleading...
Jaguars.
Yes, jaguars. It's the kind of misleading that works, and it kind of goes back to that thing of Hitch has bit of jerk in him.
Maybe not so much with Psycho, but I know that when that second Star Trek movie was coming out and everyone was like, oh, this is Wrath of Khan. This is a remake of Wrath of Khan. And J.J. Abrams is like, no, this isn't a remake of Wrath. I don't know what Wrath of Khan is. Is that a comic convention thing?
That is a good.
And then it turned out to be exactly Wrath of Khan.
That is a good example of a failed attempt to do this. Right. Now there are successful attempts where like Psycho, where you can mislead the audience, and then they go in, they're like, that was great!
Yeah.
It's like, he lied to me, but that's okay, because that was great.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But you can also get into problems. Nowadays, promotional campaigns consistently mislead the audience.
Oh, yeah.
Just because they're like, okay, so here's this movie, Guardians of the Galaxy just came out. Laugh riot. Laugh every 5 seconds. Yeah. It's like action, action, laugh, 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 action, action, laugh. Right? It's really action, laugh, laugh, and then action.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's a few jokes in it.
Right. But it wasn't the laugh riot I was expecting.
Right. Yeah. You know, I remember watching the trailer for Lilo and Stitch, which, you know, Lilo and Stitch is a super weird movie.
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. Like, they can't approximate it in the trailer, so they just put literally all the jokes in the movie in the trailer. Mm-hmm. That's all that trailer was, mm-hmm. right? Not the story, not the heartfelt story about this little broken family that's trying to stay together, which is what Lilo and Stitch is.
Right.
Just jokes, jokes, jokes. Oh, look. Stitch puts his claw on the thing and he plays Elvis out of his mouth. That little guy's hilarious.
Right.
I think there's something also to be said. The difference between what J.J. Abrams did and what Hitchcock did, Hitchcock went to great effort to try and keep it from there ever needing to be a question to ask. Mm-hmm. Hitchcock did what Rodrigo does. When he misleads us all and pushes us back in Critical Hit, another podcast in the Major Spoilers Podcast Network, he made it so there was no reason to ask, is there a mystery about Mrs. Bates? Whereas when you're talking about, when J.J. Abrams was talking about Cucumber Dick Bendybatch or whatever his name is being Khan, he flat out lied to the direct question.
Well, yes, it is. Is Benedict Cumberbatch the does he play Khan? No, he's not.
No, he plays a guy named John.
Yeah.
Now, had that movie been made and people were like, "Oh, what's this story about?" and he was like, "Well, it's about this guy and he has this thing and he does this thing," people started asking questions immediately. Whereas Hitchcock didn't do all of this to try and trick people. He did this so that people would not ask the question that might unravel the enjoyment of the big twist. Mm-hmm. And I think that, yes, it's still misleading the audience and it's still a little bit of less than honesty, but the way that it was done was masterful enough that people didn't necessarily ask why there might be an issue there. And I think that's an important point to make. That's the difference in how people accept it.
I think it's a difference on proper execution versus like Alfred Hitchcock went in, did all of his homework.
Right.
Up front. They're like, okay, what happens if somebody reads the book? I'm going to buy all the books.
Yeah.
What happens when somebody asks me, what's this movie about? I'm going to tell them this thing that leads them down the wrong direction.
Yeah.
And by the way, I'm really happy that Matthew pointed that out about my games, because when Zach was describing that, I was like, yeah, that's totally what I do for my games. I just like outright lie to the players so that they won't even suspect that something's coming to kill them.
But you do it through the voices of the characters.
Yeah. And I that's the thing is, like, when you have, it's like, it's a matter of scope, right? It's like somebody came to J.J. Abrams, who was making the Star Trek remake, and said, is this Wrath of Khan? And he couldn't, like, there was no opportunity for him to gracefully lie about it. So he just had to outright to your face lie.
Yeah, sure.
When you're coming in and you have control over everything that is going out, then you can be like, you can make it so that those questions don't even get asked.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. So the proper answer should have been, we haven't even seen the eugenics war in this Star Trek yet.
Yeah.
No, that would. No.
Yeah, because then how would you have a Wrath of Khan if you didn't have the eugenics war? We haven't even seen Space Seed in this universe yet.
That's too specific a denial. That's like when you
come
home.
Is this a remake of Wrath of Khan?
Hi, Dad, I didn't set everything on fire.
The right move would have been to actual, and we've talked about this before, probably in another podcast. Hello, if you only listen to Zach on Film, this happens a lot.
Yes.
The right answer would have been not to have Khan.
Yes.
Because there were, 12 other pods? It's like, if in this weird Star Trek universe, by the way, spoilers of Into Darkness, in this weird Star Trek universe that is now different, where things are now happening differently, they had thought out pod number 2 instead of pod number 1. You could have, because we don't
his name isn't
Khan. You don't meet any of his other peeps, right?
You meet a few of them, yes.
So they do thaw them out.
Yeah.
Okay. But they don't, like,
well, that's the whole thing. That's the whole thing.
The guy
with John,
who doesn't have a speaking line.
That's the whole thing with the John character in Into Darkness. If they'd done a pan, they do a pan over one of the frozen peoples.
Uh huh.
just the Ricardo Montalban chest in there and with a little tag on it that said Khan. That's all you would have had to do, and I probably would not be as infuriated as I was.
That's
you
right.
You could have done everything differently.
That would have been the right move, but they also wanted to have that thing where somebody shouts Khan, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sorry. Derailed.
Totally derailed.
Hitchcock!
Benedict the Cumberbatch!
What else, Zach?
Jurgens! I don't know. I think that's it. That was a really good film.
And Aubrey almost made it through the end.
Oh, yeah. She covered her
eyes. You know, if you do it right, every time you introduce your wife for the next 50 years, you'll be able to say, this is my new wife. You just said my new wife, Aubrey, earlier. You can call her that for the next 50 years.
His now wife, because, and this will get less and less common as time goes on, there's a very recent period during which she wasn't his wife.
Right.
So it's like this story happens prior to his wedding, but they are now married.
Right. Yeah.
So there's this kind of weird temporal thing where he has to specify.
Yes.
It's like when you talk about an ex-girlfriend, but the story is back when you were dating them. It's kind of like the same thing.
Yes,
my girlfriend at the time.
So we need to call
my girlfriend
like
at the time.
Zeta.
My fiance at the time.
Yeah.
Now my wife.
Yes, yes.
Right. But
hey, I still introduce my wife as my new wife.
I never get tired of that. My wife just returned from vacation, and it's fun to start saying the W word again.
Yeah. Or you could just say, you could call her your ex-fiance.
No, I don't know.
No. You'd probably need to start things before.
Also,
you'd have to say, all your stories need to say, I've got a story that happened BM.
No.
Before marriage.
No.
And this story takes place after marriage. AM. BM
also,
and AM.
Learn from my mistakes, Zach. Anyway, never refer to her as the future ex, Mrs. Wolf.
Because
that's the same thing. It's just the reverse. And then you're J.J. Abrams instead of Alfred Hitchcock.
Yeah. All right.
Oh,
so
no, because
gonna
the mystery is when.
So that's going to do it for this week on Zach on Film. Make sure to visit MajorSpoilers.com, where you can find this podcast posting page. You can give all your thoughts about Psycho and all of the different crazy things that were discussed on this show
while you were there.
Click on Amazon.com link. You can buy your own probably Blu-ray edition of Psycho and all of the other great Hitchcockian films. It's not going to cost you any extra, but a little bit. We'll come back to Major Spoilers to keep this podcasting, producing machine chugging along. Next week, we will be talking about Bullet on Zach on Film.
What's the best part of a Dunkin' Run? The coffee? Is it the coffee or the $1 donut or $2 stuffed bagel minis or $3 sausage, egg, and cheese that you can add to it? The answer, of course, is yes. Time for a Dunkin' Run. $3 offer available on sausage, egg, and cheese sandwich only. Excludes specialty donuts and fancies. Offer valid on medium or larger coffee. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer terms apply.